the Christmas season, and I'm going to be here every Sunday this month. We're staying here for Christmas this year, and so I'm excited about all that's going to be happening over the next few weeks. The Colors of Christmas this Sunday, the next couple of Sundays, and then the 23rd is going to be a very special day around here as we celebrate Christmas and have some special things happening. You want to invite your friends and family to that. It's going to be awesome here all month, and I want you to be engaged and want you to be involved and want you to be a part of it and know that it's going to be fantastic. But it's December the 2nd, and it seems like this year, at least the people that I see on social media, I know the stores that I go into, everyone was celebrating Christmas even earlier this year. People had the decorations up like right after Labor Day, you know. I'm assuming it's just a love for the season, and it really began to come alive as so many people worked so hard all week long. I mean, turning the building into Christmas was literally a week-long effort, and people were here late nights and early mornings and trying to make it happen. But it looks like Christmas. It feels like Christmas. And it's an exciting time of the year. I'm wondering how many of you are already full on into Christmas music. You got the Christmas music playing. There's a few of you. You've got Christmas music happening in your house. What is your favorite Christmas song? Anyone? Call it out to me. What's your favorite Christmas song? Silent Night, I heard. Away in a Manger. Fantastic. Oh, Holy Night. Love it. Jingle Bells. Mariah Carey's Oh Jesus. Not just Oh Jesus, Mariah Carey's Oh Jesus. I like the distinction. Not one grandma got run over by a reindeer. Not even one. Not even one. I got one. All right, fantastic. Silent Night, I love that. All good. All the classics, all of those are fantastic. Here is one of my favorite Christmas songs. I want you to hear it today. I still want you to hear it today.
Christmas without you, I'll be so blue. Just thinking about you. Decorations of red. Christmas tree won't be the same, dear, if you're not here with me. And when the blue snowflakes start falling, that's when those blue memories start.
Fantastic Christmas song. Give Elvis a hand. He was a church boy somewhere, sometime. Glad to have him praise singing with us today. The reality is, as festive and as fun as Christmas is for many people. The reality is that it's also one of the worst times of the year for others. It's difficult. It's sadness that is remembered. It's the realization of loved ones who are gone. It's past pain that still has not healed. Many reasons that people have a blue Christmas. That's what Elvis is singing about. It's blue for me. It's sad. It's difficult. It's challenging for me to think about this time of year. The song Blue Christmas is about the sadness of not having someone. But of course, that blank can be filled in with many different reasons, the personal reasons that maybe you feel the season is not as festive as you would like for it to be or as you hoped it would be, but it's a bit blue. Even though there are decorations of red on green Christmas trees, the season is an overwhelming color of blue. And I think it's important to talk about the sadness. As difficult as this is to talk about, I think it's important. I feel like the Lord mandated me to talk about this today, to deal with this. And we're not going to be dealing with this every Sunday. We're going to talk about different colors over the next few weeks, and they'll be fun. But I think this is important because it is something that's happening. It's something that is massive right now in our culture. It's not just sadness, but it's scary words like depression. And I know those words make us uncomfortable because really, we do not know enough about depression. We don't know enough about sadness to that degree or to that level. And then sometimes because we don't know about it, we ignore it. Or because we do not have the answers, then we don't feel validated in the feelings that we're feeling or the emotions that we are experiencing. And then another huge reason I think that we don't talk about it is because we do not feel safe to talk about it. The reality is today, if I were to ask by show of hands, and I'm not going to do that, but if I were to ask by a show of hands how many people have dealt with depression, it would shock you how many hands would be raised. I know we put on our Sunday best, and I see red sprinkled out and green, and we're here, even though the weather's been gloomy. It was miserable yesterday, and we have this kind of overcast sky. We put on our very best, and we come to church, and we sometimes it's all the emotion that we can muster just to receive the hellos from others or give the hugs back to those that are offering, when inside there is this battle going on, there is this challenge going on, there is this foreboding, there is this darkness, if you will, there is this struggle because we are dealing with depression. Where is this coming from? You ask. It's been on my mind for a while, been in my spirit for a while. I suppose one of the catalysts for that was just 3 months ago. I don't know if you saw this on social media. It really did go viral. But there was a young pastor, just 30 years old in California, who took his life. And it was shocking. I did not know this pastor. I had never met him before. But his story just captivated me for weeks. I was just reading everything I could read. I was going back and listening to past messages that he was teaching and preaching in the mega church that he pastored. Thousands of people in California. Beautiful wife, 3 young boys, like 2 years old, 4 years old, and maybe 7 years old. Young boys, a beautiful, beautiful family, this incredible church. I mean, when you look on the outside, it just looks like everything is so right. And why in the world would he make this decision? Makes no sense whatsoever as to why he would do it. And often we ignore what does not make sense. Because we like problems that we can sort of attach a blueprint to them. We like for there to be reasons as to why we feel the way we do and why we're going through the things that we're going through. But sometimes with these emotional struggles, with these mental struggles, there is no blueprint. There is no exact diagnosis. There is no precise prescription to fix it. And so we don't know what to do with it, so we do not talk about it, and we do not deal with it, and the problem just gets worse and worse. I am no doctor today. I absolutely am no doctor today, but we have to try to help. We have to try to help the network of pastors that I'm connected to, the close friends and people that I share accountability with. This is something that we talked about for weeks, and we checked on one another, and you know, this was a shock to this pastor's friends. So where are you and how are you doing? And after we made sure that each of us were okay and there wasn't some secret, you know, something going on in our own personal lives, all of us agreed, you know what, we have to talk to our churches about this. We have to help the people that we lead spiritually, because no doubt this is massive. This is massive. And no doubt there are people that are in our congregations that are struggling with things like this and dealing with things like this. And we have to do what we can to at least begin the conversation so that we can find healing. Because the truth is, we're hearing more about mental illness and depression than ever in our lifetime. And I believe, I'm not a doctor, you're going to get my opinion today and get my perspective and get the culmination of what I've read and tried to glean and learn about this, but I do believe that it's physical, I believe that it's psychological, and I absolutely believe that it is spiritual. All three of those things play a role. They factor in. In fact, let me give you the definition of depression. This is not my definition, but let me give you the definition of depression. I think it is on the screen where you can see it as well. But it is a mood disorder characterized by anhedonia. That's a clinical word, a big word, but what that word means, it's the inability to feel pleasure. So let me break that down, and so that you get that in just real common everyday language, this anhedonia, the inability to feel pressure. Here's the thing. The thing that used to bring you pleasure no longer does. The thing that used to make you happy no longer does. That's anhedonia. So characterized by anhedonia, extreme sadness, poor concentration, sleep problems, loss of appetite, feelings of guilt, helplessness, and hopelessness. I don't know about you, but when I read that, I'm thinking, yeah, that's all of us. Some degree or another, in some way or another, some aspect, that's all of us. We've all felt those feelings. Am I the only one? Is there just an amen just somewhere? Yeah, that we've all felt that before, except for the loss of appetite. That's the only one. Pray for me. But we've all felt these feelings. And I'm astounded, because literally, my opinion, I believe this is the number one health issue in the world right now. Did you know that 1 in 9 people are currently on some type of depression medication? And 1 in 5 have been on some type of depression medication. Currently, the use of these medications has risen by 300%. That's how many people are using these. And yet there is a stigma. There is a stigma. And if you have ever felt the other end of that stigma, or if you've ever felt made fun of, or if you've ever felt shamed in any way, or if you've ever felt like what you're dealing with is not real. Let me apologize for whomever made you feel that way. Certainly that is not going to be the case here at the church at Covington, because the reality is if I were to stand up here today and tell you that I damaged my foot or I hurt my arm or I've got something wrong with a kidney, you would not even second guess it. You would tell me about medications you're aware of. You would tell me about something you heard your cousin's doctor say to them, and you wouldn't think anything about giving me advice for how to fix whatever was ailing me. But let me tell you that I'm facing something mentally, and all of a sudden we run because we don't know what to tell people. We don't know what to say to people. We don't know how to help people who are facing these things. And so there is this stigma, and it is not fair. It's not fair to those who are dealing with this. Let me say to those who are wrestling today, those who are dealing today, those who are struggling today with any emotion of depression, any feeling of just downness that's trying to become depression, or for someone who's having to medicate or having to struggle your way through this, let me just say this today. It's okay for you not to be okay. It's okay for you to not be okay. That doesn't mean that we want you to accept where you are. That doesn't mean that we don't want you to fight your way through that or push your way through that or claw your way out of that darkness. But I want you to know that whatever it is that you're dealing with, whatever it is that you're going through, just like I would say for any other person, it's okay for you to not be okay because you're dealing with this diagnosis or that diagnosis. It's okay for you to be struggling mentally. You're not going to be made fun of. You're not going to be thrown out. You're not going to be pushed aside. We want to help you and see you completely whole and healed and walking in the strength of the Lord. But surprisingly, depression is largely lifestyle related. Again, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not diagnosing today, and that's not hard and fast. I'm just telling you what majority of psychiatrists and psychologists, the overall opinion is that depression is lifestyle related. They call it the disease of lifestyle. How does that work? Stephen Ilardi, the author of The Depression Cure, not necessarily a Christian guy, or all of his writings, do they necessarily promote or propose what you and I do here today, but he said something interesting. He said, we were never designed for the sedentary, indoor, socially isolated, fast food laden, sleep deprived, frenzied pace of modern life. That's why they call it the lifestyle disease. Did you see yourself in that? You saw yourself sitting in a fast food line just this week, or four times this week. We were not meant for that. We were not meant to be alone. We were not meant to just sit in our houses by ourselves and not be in community, not be connected with people, not sharing life with people. That's why small groups are so important around here. We're going to see them again in the new year, and you ought to get into one of them because it's so very important for you to do life with other people and this to be more than just a Sunday experience in your life, but to be connected, because we were not designed for this socially isolated pace in life. And that's many of us. This lifestyle, per the experts, is reshaping our brains. It explains why depression is on the rise. Let me give you a few other reasons, just my opinions. Take them, grab them, throw them away if you want to, but it's just my opinion. But I think that cell phones and social media are hurting us badly. I think kids who are raised with iPads and tablets, who watch stuff constantly. It's reshaping our brains. The iPhone, the most recent update, it happens on Sunday morning, so I always feel like a complete jerk on my way to church, usually when it comes in and tells you how much screen time you had in the last week. Does anyone see this if you're an Apple user, iPhone user? It'll tell you how many minutes and or hours you've looked at your phone per day. And it's astounding. It's astounding. We were on the way to church today and Jude got his alert and he was reading it. And he's like, 51 minutes, you know. And he said, wow, I'm doing much better than all of you. Talking about me and Mom and Elle. It's astounding. You don't realize how often you look at your phone. And I make all the same excuses. Well, this is my work. I'm on here. I'm doing emails. I get it. I'm doing all of that stuff as well. But it's amazing how much we have our faces buried into some kind of a screen. It's reshaping our brains. Then there is the lack of identity, another huge contributing factor to depression, lack of identity. There is massive depression among those who are confused about who they are. Those who are confused about who they are sexually. People who are wrestling this whole thing in America now. It's not a he baby or a she baby. It's gender neutral and they're just babies now. We have all this going on, and there's so much depression, there's so much mental anguish that is attached to it. Or the inability to process pain. Instead of processing, we medicate. We drink too much. We binge too much. We drown ourselves to keep from dealing with the pain. The inability to process pain. It's massive, it's huge as to contributing to our emotional state of mind. Here's another one that's big. It's peer-to-peer mentoring. Peer-to-peer mentoring. No longer are we an elder to young person society, meaning that the elder is willing to take time to teach the younger, or that the younger is willing to listen to the elder. And so now what we do, and that's beside the pastor to saint relationship, because now the pastor has been reduced down to a coach that can be hired and fired. I'm not that one. We reduce it down, so now it's peer-to-peer mentoring. What does that mean? That means we shop for the opinion that agrees with what we want to do, right or wrong. And generally, the person whose affirmation we are seeking doesn't have the wisdom to disagree anyway. They don't have the life experience to pull from to disagree anyway. We need elders to mentor. I know older generation. I know you are frustrated with the younger generation. I get it. I understand. I feel like I'm like right in between, and so I get frustrated. I know you're frustrated, but I'm asking you to find a rebirth and a renewal of passion in this new year to say, you know what? I'm going to try again, because I remember how hard-headed I was. I remember how obstinate I was. I remember how difficult I was. And so I'm going to make sure that my only friends are not just people that are my same age. I'm going to try to pull in some of these younger ones and say, I want you to go to lunch with me. And then when I get there, I want to listen to what they have to say and just see if I can be a mentor in their life. And I would say to the younger ones who think that the older generation has nothing to contribute, you're crazy. This nation was built by their hands and their wisdom and their sacrifice. They have so much to say and so much to contribute and so much wisdom. And they may not use all the hip words. They may not know all of the language. Sometimes you got to decipher through lots and lots and lots of questions. But if you can just listen for a few moments, one of the parents here at the church was telling me that they were telling their teenage children, when you're in service, just listen. They were challenging. You're always looking at your phone, and it's what we all do is this, but just listen. If you have to close your eyes, just listen, because these words, they are life. Not because I'm speaking them, but because they are based and founded in the Word of God. They will make a difference in your life. And then there is this narcissistic culture. Stop taking selfies. What in the world? We are so focused on self. We are so into ourselves. We are just, you know, just in mirrors with duck faces and pursed lips. And what kills me is some woman with her pursed lips, like she's kissing everyone that's looking at her picture, and then there's a scripture underneath it. Why'd you put a scripture underneath that? Ain't nobody thinking about the Lord when you kissing them on the screen. Just using any excuse whatsoever to be narcissistic, to focus on self. It's crazy. But it's where we are. It's what we're dealing with. And then there is the extreme of how some choose to resolve these feelings in their lives. I gotta say this. I gotta deal with this today because it's too important. Did you know that 1 million people per year worldwide commit suicide? 1 million people worldwide. 40,000 people in America per year choose to end their lives. That's double the murder rate. It is the number one killer of kids ages 15 to 24. And we don't talk about this. We have to talk about this. The reality is, suicide is a permanent, irreversible attempt to solve a temporary problem. And for the person that's wrestling with that, for the person that feels like that is their only option, they did not hear what I just said, because there is nothing temporary about their problem. There is nothing finite about their issue. There is nothing momentary about the circumstance. And so they just think the only option, no, that is permanent and it is irreversible. And I would love for you to see your problems and even the emotion that you feel and the pull that you feel toward this permanent decision. I would love for you to see that as the waves that are rolling in like the tide. When you're there on the beach at high tide, the waves are rolling in so strong. But guess what? They always roll back out. And you may be in a season right now where the waves are really rushing, and maybe they're over your head, and maybe they're stronger than you can stand up under. But if you can just find a way to hold on, if you can just find a way to just stay put, if you're getting knocked around, I get it, but if you can just find a way to just touch the bottom every now and then and just get moments of balance here and there, get to church and be in the presence of God and sing the songs and engage yourself, if you can just find a way to hold on, the water will roll out, and you don't have to die to end your pain. So what does the Bible say? I got to hurry. I got way more message than I have time today. But what does the Bible say? Because God is not silent on the subject. He understands. In fact, much of the Bible, this may surprise you, but much of the Bible and many faith heroes in the Bible are people who went through very distressing, depression-like times. The Bible was written by some very emotional people, sometimes emotionally unstable people. There's a book called Lamentations. You ought to read that sometimes. It's an entire book where Jeremiah shared his depression. It's literally what it is. He's lamenting. He's going through, woe is me. I'm just terrible and pitiful and can't believe I made this decision or that decision. In fact, let me read Lamentations chapter 3, verses 17 through 20. Say this, I have been deprived of peace. I have forgotten what prosperity is. So I say, my splendor is gone and all that I had hoped from the Lord. I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I well remember them, and my soul is downcast within me. Look what he's saying. He's saying, I have been deprived, whether it's real or perceived, I have been deprived of peace. And then he said, I've forgotten what prosperity is. He's not talking about the money kind. He's just talking about good things. He's talking about the good. I would that your soul would prosper and that you would be in health. That kind of prosperity, the stuff that just gets you up in the morning. He said, I've forgotten what any of that even is. Why? That's why it's so important to be in church hearing God's good news for your life. I've already said that to someone today. You get the plan and you stick with the plan because you know the plan is the right thing to do. You just keep coming. You keep coming. You keep coming. Even when you don't feel like it, you keep coming. I know that's easier said than done. And you're saying, well, preacher, you're paid to be here. I know. I understand all of that. I'm not preaching down to you today. I'm trying to talk to you from a place of empathy that says, look, you can't give up. You can't throw in the towel. You can't quit. You just have to keep taking steps. But the problem is, I'm forgetting what I should be remembering, and I'm remembering what I should be forgetting. That's a mouthful right there. I'm forgetting what I should be. I should be remembering how good God has been to me. That's what made last Sunday so powerful, and the Spirit of the Lord rushed into this place and we were worshiping the Lord around this altar. What was happening? We were remembering. We were remembering how good God has been to us. It probably didn't dawn on you why last week was such a good week for you, or why things went your way, or why things turned in your favor. Man, look back to last Sunday when you were just saying, Lord, I give you thanks in everything. And he said, you know what? I like that so much. I'm going to make sure your week is blessed. So we forget what we're supposed to remember. And then we remember what we're supposed to forget. We remember every hurt, every cause of bitterness, every act of abuse and pain. We remember all of that. And then we're like Jeremiah. I don't even know what to do. Psychologists call it ruminating. Ruminating. It's the same word, it's the same idea as the cow chewing its cud. It's not very pleasant, but you understand the cow, when they eat, they swallow it for a little while, and then they bring it back up, and they chew it some more. Nasty. Try that at lunch today. Oh, no, you'd never consider doing that in the natural, but we do it emotionally and mentally all the time. We get healed of something, we get helped with something, we get touched, and then we start trying to pull that thing back up. Reaching up under the blood, trying to pull out our past mistakes, and we ruminate. We ruminate. What's the result of all of this? Yeah, you guessed it. He said, my soul is downcast. I'm depressed. I'm sad. I'm struggling. 2 Corinthians 1:8. Paul said, we do not want you to be uninformed, brothers and sisters, about the troubles we experienced in the province of Asia. We were under great pressure, far beyond our ability to endure, so that we despaired of life itself. I'm talking about the Apostle Paul, who said we were under so much pressure. We were so far beyond our ability to cope that we did not want to live any longer. That's how real it gets. That's how difficult it gets. And so the goal today is to say you're okay, you're not weird, you're not out of the norm. Life happens and life is hard sometimes, but maybe we can turn the blue, maybe we can turn the blue that Elvis is singing about into a brighter color this Christmas. I hope you'll hold on to next Sunday when we change colors, and the next Sunday when we change colors again. I hope you'll give the word time and chance and opportunity to move and to work in your life and just say, you know what, I don't like my present circumstances. In fact, like Paul, I'm despairing even of life. This is so far beyond anything I feel like I'm equipped to handle. But what if you just held on and you just keep seeking the Lord and you just keep reaching for Him? There's a famous story in the Bible about Elijah. And I don't have time to preach it today. I got to hurry. But Elijah is in this face-off with the prophets of Baal. Baal is a false god. This is all in 1 Kings chapter 18. You can read this. But he's in this face-off with these 400 plus prophets of Baal. And they're arguing back and forth about whose God is true. And so they settle on this competition. You build an altar and you sacrifice to your God. And then when you're finished, I'll build an altar and I'll make sacrifices to my God. And whosoever God answers by fire, that's the true God. So the Bible said that the prophets of Baal, they built an altar, they made sacrifices, they prayed, chanted, did all they knew to do, and there was nothing that happened. Nothing. So it was Elijah's turn. Elijah built an altar. He made sacrifice, and then he started calling for water. Bring water. Bring buckets and buckets of water until they literally drowned the sacrifice. You realize that if you want something to catch on fire, you don't want it to be drowned in water. But Elijah is so confident in his God that he drowns the sacrifice with water and then prays a 62 or 63 word prayer. And when God sends the fire, the Bible says that he consumed the sacrifice, he consumed the water, he consumed the rocks that laid and built the altar. He took every single bit of it. He completely answered by fire. And don't you know that Elijah was walking tall that afternoon? That's my God. And that's awesome and it's incredible until you get to 1 Kings chapter 19. You know your Bible today. It's powerful. It's interesting that your lows don't always come when you're already low. No, usually your lows come after great victories. My greatest time of mental struggle is on Sunday night. After we've had great Sundays and people get saved and baptized people, and Sunday night, man, I'm looking for a grocery store to go to or just get busy. I don't want to just sit and think what I could have done better, what I could have said different, or what conversation didn't go exactly like I hoped it would, or what would happen. No, it's after high highs. That's when the enemy comes in. Let me read just a little of this. I'm hurrying, but 1 Kings 19, verses 1 through 4. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, "May the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them." She's mad. She's angry. She's furious that all of these prophets of Baal, because what Elijah did after his God answered by fire is he killed all the 400 plus prophets of Baal with a sword. And so she said, you let your God do the same thing to me if I do not do to you what you did to those prophets. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. Makes no sense. He just killed 400 false prophets, but he's scared of a woman. He just killed 400 men with a sword, and this woman says, "I'm coming to get you," and he is running now for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there. Big mistake. He had no business being alone. Left his servant behind, left his family behind, left his covering behind. Left the one who knew him the best behind. Left the one who knew his weakness. Left the one who knew his proclivity. Left the one who knew his inclinations. He left that one behind while he himself went a day's journey. That's a long way. He went a day's journey into the wilderness. He came to a broom brush, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. This is what he said to the Lord: "I have had enough. Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. Take my life." He wants to die. There's four things I want you to see from this today. The first one is faulty thinking. Faulty thinking. It's the reality for most of us and where we are, what we're feeling, the emotions, the foreboding, the overwhelming. It's faulty thinking. It's the number one cause of depression, in my opinion. It's self-talking. It's ruminating on the negative. It's feeling sorry for ourselves. Paul said it in Philippians, "Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things." Thinking about the wrong stuff. If I'm thinking about all the negative and all that's gone wrong and all that's happening, I'm thinking about the wrong things. It's faulty thinking. And then it's isolation. Isolation. Elijah left everyone behind and went way off by himself. It's not smart. You may have isolated yourself and you're saying, "Wait a minute, no, I'm in this room. There's dozens of people sitting all around me." But you know what? It's possible to be in this room full of people and still feel all alone. Because we isolate ourselves in our minds, and loneliness gets so real. May not be lonely for a person, but alone in your thoughts. You're the only person you listen to. That's dangerous if you're the only person you listen to. Because when I'm not thinking right, I'm the last person I should be taking advice from. I'm not going to call them. I'm just going to think about this. I know I should get their advice. I'm going to just do what I think is best. Pastored a lady for a number of years, and we got to know one another quite well. At least her emotional, mental state. And it took a long time. I knew it before she said it, but finally, in lucid, peaceful time, she said, "Look, I've got some mental struggles. Okay, let's talk about that." And over the years and through the building of relationship, just kind of became that person in her world who, when she felt the darkness coming, building, when the clouds begin to gather, she would call, I'm there, is all she would have to say, or it's coming. And it was going to be a conversation, not always an easy conversation. Sometimes it was easy to kind of keep her from going down that road, and other times it was much more difficult. I remember one particular season, it was weeks and weeks, and we would talk, and I'm trying to rationalize and reason, but there is no reason, no logical rationalization for why she was in the situation that she was in or what it was that was going on. It really came down to thinking someone had said something. It was so small. What someone else would say, who cares what they think? It was the catalyst. It was the match that lit this. I can't even go into all that detail, but I mean, it's incredibly real to people that feel that way. That's why you need people who know you. You need to be in small groups. You need to be connected to other people who know you. And then the third thing is that Elijah was led by his feelings. I know you know this, but I'm going to remind you of it. Your feelings will lie to you. Remember, they're like waves. They come in, they go out. Jesus said it this way in John 8:32. He said, "I want you to know the truth, and then the truth to set you free." Don't be led by feelings. They're wonderful. They're great when they're great. They're terrible when they're terrible. So I can't allow my life to be governed by feelings. And then the fourth thing that Elijah does is he fights comparison. "I'm no better than my ancestors," he says. Why do we do this? We don't even know our ancestors, but we do this on social media. We compare our lowest moment, our hardest day, to someone else's highlight reel. I'm telling you, that picture that you're looking at is so filtered and has been taken so many times. It's not reality. No one puts their messy kitchen on Facebook. You only see the remodeled ones that are perfect. What do? I live for an audience of one. I'm not trying to compare myself to you. I'm trying to get the approval of God in my life. That's who I need. That's who I want. Galatians 1 and 10, am I now trying to win the approval of human beings or of God? Or am I trying to please people? If I were still trying to please people, I would not be a servant of Christ. I'm not trying to please people. I'm trying to please the Lord. And if I depend on what people think about me, then it's going to keep me from doing what Jesus has called me to do. I do not have time to go back to 1 Kings 19, but take the time to read verses 5 through 19. Get home this afternoon. If you want to re-listen to the podcast, pause it, read this. The Bible, it says that he lay down and he fell asleep. And when he went to sleep, all at once an angel touched him and said, "Get up and eat." For some of you, the best prescription that you need is just to find a place to rest. Get yourself something good to eat. Somebody that appreciates food over there, they understand the power of a good meal. Sometimes I tell Kristen, I need to go eat somewhere. Dara, we don't have the money to go there. I know, but I need to go there. I need to go. If I got to take out a loan, I need to go. Because it's like medication to me. I'm preaching to myself today. Let me just... He looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked over hot coals and a jar of water. Look what it said. It said he ate and drank, and then he lay down again. This is the best day of Elijah's life. This is fantastic. But the angel comes back a second time. Get up and eat. The journey is too much for you. He got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights till he reached Horeb. That's when he went into a cave. And the Lord said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "Look, here's the deal. I have been zealous for you. I've been on fire for you. I have worked for you. I have been obedient to you. I've done all that you've asked me to do. And now I got someone trying to kill me." He said, "I'm the only one who's out here being who you need them to be, living this life that you've asked us to live. I'm the only one." And the Lord said, "No, Elijah, actually you're not. I've got 7,000 others. You don't even know anything about them." "Huh? What? You mean I'm not the only one going through, dealing with, wrestling? No. You mean I'm not the only one in this room? No. There's other people." So the Bible said that the Lord spoke to him in the fire, spoke to him in the wind, and then he came with a still small voice. I don't know how God's going to speak to you today. I've got four other things I want to give you today. I want to tell you, but I'm... You got 3 minutes. 3 minutes. It's literally what he led Elijah through. How he healed him, how he healed his mind. I can't tell you the problem and then not tell you the solution. So he told him to get healthy physically. I know. Get outside. Change it up today. Find a hobby. Take up bird watching. Eat a proper meal. Like actually take time to chew your food. Psalm 127, "To in vain you rise early and stay up late, toiling for food to eat. He grants sleep to those he loves." We're in this rat race, fighting. And he said, it's all in vain if we're not careful. Number two, he told him, pour your heart out to God. He encouraged him to be honest. I encourage you today to be honest with God. I literally was taught all of my formative faith years that I could not question God. Anyone else ever been taught that? I mean, you just could not question God. You couldn't ever express. Looking back on it now, it was an extreme teaching. But you could not ever question God. You just had to accept everything as God's will. And I don't remember when it dawned on me. I don't remember when it happened, Jason. I don't remember what thing I went through in my life that I just rebelled against that teaching and just, God, why? Waited for the lightning and it didn't come. Instead, I felt him wrap his arms around me. And I realized something. Wait a minute, you can pour your heart out to God. You can tell God all about your troubles. You can say, Lord, I do not understand this. Elijah said all kinds of silly things to God. God can handle your crazy talk. We may not be able to. We may not understand it. But God knows. Find you a room. Find you a closet. Find you a car with the windows rolled up. Tell it to Jesus. That's what he said. He said, come to me and I will give you rest. And then, third, I would say experience the power and presence of God. We're working so hard at this around here. Building services that take you up where you need to go spiritually. Inform you, equip you, prepare you for the week ahead. Power moments, presence moments. Why I tell our worship, there's no wasted Sunday. There's no Sunday where we just, let's just throw these songs at them. No, why? Because we're trying to create an atmosphere where people experience the power and the presence of God. You know why? Because you can go to 10 different doctors that say, checked your blood pressure, it's fine. Checked your heart, it's good. I've looked inside your ears with that scope and everything's clear. Tested your reflexes and everything is just jerking and doing what it's supposed to do. But doctor, I still feel this. Got to get in the presence of God. Yes. And what doctor cannot explain, and what doctor has no answer for, I was glad when they said to me, I gotta go to the house of God because I know that in his presence is fullness of joy and there's peace, peace, peace like a river. But you know what we have to do? We have to turn down the world's volume. Got to turn down the world's volume and you got to turn up the sound of God in your life. I'm telling you, for so many of you in this room today, the problem is not this or that. It's more spiritual than it is physical. It's more spiritual than psychological. Number four. Let God give me a new purpose and direction for my life. Because nothing gives me purpose or meaning in more profound ways than God saying, I have an assignment for you. I've got something I want you to do. I want you to be a part of Team Church. I want you to be on our greeter team. I want you to hold an umbrella on Sunday morning in the rain. I want you to decorate for God. I want you to do something in my house. Turn up the volume of Jesus in your life. Turn down the volume of the world. There is freedom in the name, healing in the name, power in the name, salvation in the name, life in the name. There is no other but Jesus. There is